Hello, I'm Michael Bott.
And I'm Rupert Soskin.
And this is the Standing with Stones Megalithic Podcast.
This podcast is only made possible by monthly donations from our listeners who've supported us through Patreon.com. You can become one of our patrons for as little as a dollar a month by visiting patreon.com/standingwithstones.
So, welcome to the seventh Standing with Stones monthly podcast. My goodness, it almost sounds like we know what we're doing. And in this month's episode, we're going to dig a little deeper into how archaeologists can say they know certain things.
Yes, indeed. It dawned on us recently that we often mention things like, well, things like isotope analysis. We banged on a lot about that recently.
Yes.
And so when, for example, when archaeologists say that they know cattle remains in Wiltshire came from Orkney.
Yeah, I mean, but it's not necessarily just the isotope stuff. But, I mean, things like the Langdale axe heads that are found all over the country. How do we know they actually came from the same place? It ain't just because they look the same.
Indeed, that's true. So,
is it?
So there you go. Yes, we're going to be getting a little bit more science-y this month.
Yeah, but not in a dull way.
No. Heaven forbid.
Definitely not in a dull way, no. Not our style, is it? Probably lost half our listeners now. No, moving quickly along before you go away. I just wanted to do a shout out, actually, Rupert, for all the good people that are supporting us via Patreon.
Fantastic, yes, we should do that.
And I think, you know, we promised mention of them here, there and everywhere, but I don't think we've done it that much. So just to set the record straight, I'm going to read out all the names. Now, I'm not going to do this every month. You know, I'll probably just read out the ones that have joined in the month, you know, in future.
Yes.
But it isn't a vast list yet, but it's growing. So anyway, I'm going to start at the beginning, which is a very good place to begin, with Mr. Chris Brooks, followed by Mo Keown, Carol Ellis, Rosamund Bott. Yes, that is my sister. Julie Richardson. Margaret Bailey, Dom Escott, Brian Platt, Ben Clay, Neil Shostag, Sacred Stones Limited, otherwise known as Toby Angel, I do believe, builder
indeed
of modern long barrows, Janice Belcher Heath, Fiona Robson, Safik Gal, I don't know Safik Gal's real name, wish I did, Julie Parkinson, Brent Haugen, Judith White, Kevin Lewis, David Potter, Sean Hawthorne, John Emmerich, Ben Glancy, Jane Hutzel, Catherine Gordon, Thomas Ambrose, Patrick Ford, and joining us this month, Denise McLeod, Lainey Irvin, and William Misko. Thank you, thank you, thank you to you all.
Thank you all, indeed. Yeah. Fantastic.
So, great job. Glad we've done that. I thought also, before we kick off proper, a little behind-the-scenes update.
Yes, why not?
Some of the stuff that we've been up to and, you know, what have we got planned, that kind of thing. I mean, the big thing at the beginning of this month or earlier this month has been getting out the first video that Rupert and I have done together properly since we finished filming on Standing with Stones, and that's our little piece about the Devil's Quoits near Oxford.
Yes, in Stanton Hardcourt. And it was wonderful to be back in the saddle, and amazing, actually, that it might as well have been yesterday that we finished filming, mind it. It just, seamless it was, seamless.
Yes, yeah. And we're very pleased with the results, and the feedback has been very good. And, well, we've started as we intend to go on, of course. And right now we're trying to think of what to, because you're coming over here again in November, so there'll be
I'm trying to make it a lot more frequent, yes. And,
yeah.
Yes, we haven't decided what we're doing next, because there are so many variables and it's exciting. You know, we want to be telling you things that you don't know.
Yeah.
Or showing you things that you don't know.
Yeah, rather than making things up.
Yes, indeed. yes, definitely a watch this space. Anyway, it's something that we're going to be doing regularly.
Yes, indeed. Oh, there was another little trinket. I put out a little video homage to Tinkin's Wood Burial Chamber.
Yeah, it was a lovely piece, that, yes.
Yeah, it's very short, but to the point.
Yes, do you know what? It's amazing because it's a long time since the last time I was there was when we were there together, when we were shooting stones. And I'll be honest, I had I'd forgotten a lot of those just little visual details. I remembered obviously the ridiculously huge capstone, and and the remarkable dry stone walling at the front.
Remarkable, because I think that herringbone dry stone walling is wrong.
Yes.
And I think that's a that's a
modern folly.
That's a conceit. Yes.
Yes. I think you're probably right. But I'd completely forgotten about that. Really.
It is a monstrous sight because of that capstone, but it is quite some place. Yeah, go and visit it not far from Cardiff. Just west of Cardiff. And open house we've got coming up. That'll be next week. It should have been tonight.
Yes.
This night that we're recording the podcast.
Actually, that's an interesting point, saying that on a podcast, isn't it? When people could be listening to this at absolutely any point in history. Saying next week is kind of...
Yes, by next week, at this point in time, we mean Wednesday, the 17th of October, 2018. So I think that's about it. So much activity has put us a bit behind time. So this podcast is late coming out.
Not least of all because I was over visiting my new grandson. So
and congratulations on that.
Well, I thank you. Yes.
So I think that's enough of this examining our navel. time to move on with some excitement. And
yes.
First of all, of course, we'll be pushing back the boundaries. Mm. So, as I said, kicking off with pushing back the boundaries as usual. What have you got this time, Rupert?
Yeah, well, I couldn't resist this one. Do you remember?
Well, you can't resist a packet of wine gum, so it better be good.
Sad but true. Sad but true. Yeah, my teeth will tell you all about that. No, I couldn't resist this one because you remember over the last few months, really, we've talked about, you know, finding the oldest wine in the world, finding the oldest cheese. We found the oldest olive oil.
You're not saying we've found the oldest twiglets.
Good as. But, you know, do you remember last month when we talked about the oldest bread that was found at a Natufian site that was it was over 14,000 years old. It was staggering.
Yeah.
Really, you know, pre-agriculture bread. Well, this time we're back with the Natufians and they just keep on surprising us.
They keep on giving.
They certainly do. And there's one particular site that's been, actually, it's been pushing back the boundaries of a number of things. And it's the Rakafet Cave. I think that's the right pronunciation. Good as. It's on the southeastern side of Mount Carmel. And the astonishing thing is it was occupied for millennia. In fact, for an extraordinary length of time. And archaeologists have been excavating the cave since the early 70s. And they've uncovered layer after layer of evidence for human occupation. There's charcoal fires, so they've dug up charcoal from fires going back a staggering 36,000 years.
Yikes.
It's amazing. But the article that first caught my eye about Rakafet is that they've found evidence for the earliest known cereal-based beer, dating back 13,000 years.
Whoa. Now, wait a minute. The Natufian bread we talked about last month was around 14,500 years old. Yeah.
Yes.
And this beer dates back 13,000 years.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that's still a fair old way before there was any systematic farming or agriculture. So the Natufians must have spent quite a bit of time, gone to an awful lot of effort gathering wild ingredients for their beer and their bread.
Absolutely. It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, it's the time to go finding all those as, you know, wild foraging, basically, to bring back enough for that sort of production.
Yeah, yeah.
But
it takes something.
Yeah, it's amazing. But another thing they've found at this site is there are burials associated with the cave, and it's the earliest evidence for flowers around a grave.
Wow.
Which that's kind of prehistoric romance, isn't it? The fact that we've been associating flowers with the dead. I mean, in many ways, it shouldn't be a surprise, but it always is a surprise when we find evidence for something. It's a bit intoxicating, really.
And but, it humanizes something from all that time ago. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, all in all, they sound like a remarkably sophisticated culture, and one that dates from the earliest periods of civilization we know of.
Wonderful. So glad you thought of doing these pushing back the boundaries things. I mean, these finds keep flagging up just how much we still don't know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
On the other hand, I mean, it feels like the floor keeps moving under our feet. You know?
Isn't that the truth? Yes.
Yeah. So it's a case of links on the website then.
Indeed.
Yes, for anything that pops up that you've missed or haven't comprehended, or thought we'd gone too fast over, we'll be providing links as usual on the website. So, Rupert, yes.
Yeah. Well, it's on to news then, isn't it? So,
hooray!
Yay! So what wonders do you have to start us off this month, Michael?
Oh, it's me, is it? Okay, right. Well, this is different. Well, this is different. Well, this is different.
Well, this is different. That's an in-joke.
It is, unless you're one of the select few that have seen the bloopers and outtakes from Standing with Stones, the film. You'll know what we're talking about. Anyway, well, this is different, and it's a big hurrah for responsible detectorists.
Oh, right, do tell.
Yeah, a little while back in 2017, not long ago at all, some Swiss treasure hunters out with their metal detectors made a remarkable find of a 3,500-year-old bronze hand, along with a couple of other artifacts. The hand was decorated with a gold-leaf cuff and was clearly something special, so they handed it on to the Archaeological Service in Bern, who, in turn, guessed that there was probably more to be found at this location. So they returned to the site to make a more rigorous excavation and found that the owner of the hand, the original owner, was buried nearby over a stone structure of some sort.
Right.
And they also found a missing piece of the hand, which proved it had definitely been buried there. Intriguingly enough, the wrist end of the hand contained a socket, and they're wondering if it may even have been a prosthetic.
Oh, come on. Can you imagine?
Is that going too far?
I wonder. If that's true, how cool would that be? I mean, a genuine Bronze Age metal limb. How sure are they?
Well, I don't think they can be that sure because it wasn't found attached to his skeleton. They've theorised that maybe the socket could have been to connect it to some sort of sceptre or wand or a stick, you never know. But when they've done more testing, analysis of the socket, you know, never know, it might shed some more light on the true usage.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing is, it's a beautiful thing to look at, as I say, we'll be posting stuff on the website so you can see it. Yeah, it's quite a beautiful piece of work.
Fabulous find. Indeed, whatever it was used for. I do love the idea of it being a prosthetic, though. That would be fantastic. Well, I'll tell you what, I have got
a Goldfinger. That's bronze finger, sorry.
Oh, dear. Well, I've got a drug-related one here.
Oh, good.
Yes. this is quite different. Researchers from the University of York and the British Museum, they've run tests on a little Bronze Age jug that came from Cyprus, actually, which has it's still sealed, or it was until they did the test anyway. So the contents were still in a very good state of preservation. And analysis revealed that the contents were opiate alkaloids. And one of the reasons that people are so excited about these results is that it's the first time the opium poppy has been proven to have links with this style of jug.
So what I can't quite understand, is there something special about the jug, or is it?
It's a good question, actually. It's apparently, it's been a theory for a long time that these, they're called base ring juglets, actually.
Of course they are.
but it's long been theorized that they could be connected with trade in opium, wait for it, because the jugs apparently resemble the upturned seed head of the opium poppy.
Oh, fair enough.
Well, no, personally, I think it's a load of tosh.
Well, on the other hand,
what do I know? Well, the thing is, as far as I can see, I think the resemblance could have been a lot closer if they were actually making them specifically to be representative of the plant. You know, they don't really, you know, in the vaguest possible way. And B, I think a bulbous body with a long, slender neck is just a very practical shape for a jug, because it's got a low centre of gravity, and even if it does get knocked over, the shape of it prevents all the contents from just spilling out in one big whoosh. But, you know, they think that it looks like an upturned seed head.
Well, fair enough. Well, if I'd been the one that said, hey, that jug looks like an upturned seed head, perhaps it's something to do with opium. Well, I'd be punching the air right now. Yes! You couldn't persuade me with your curmudgeonliness there, Mr. Soskin.
Yeah, I know. I know that I am the eternal cynic, but
yes.
It seems a little bit tenuous to me.
Nevertheless, still another fascinating insight into Bronze Age culture. And throws up all manner of questions about the use of drugs in prehistory. Maybe that's an interesting topic for another podcast.
Why not?
Yeah, actually, I'm going to end this month's news section with more cultural consumables.
Go on.
And, well, this could really have been another Pushing Back the Boundaries piece.
Uh-huh.
And we're going back to Cattle Hoyuk in Turkey.
Oh, okay.
Now, that's got to be, without doubt, the most studied ancient settlement in the world.
Indeed it is.
And it's been revealing more of its secret in the light of more modern technology.
Right.
Modern technology later on. An international team of scientists have been analysing the residues from ceramic pots dating back 8,000 years or so, and they're getting some fascinating results showing quite how sophisticated our ancestors were back then. Now, the thing that made this research shift up a gear is the more recent technique of protein analysis, which offers a lot more information than, say, specifically looking at animal fats.
Right.
The individual proteins have shown evidence for cheese from cows, sheep, and goats.
Oh, wow. So how do they know it was cheese and not other usage of milk? Or is that a stupid question?
Not a stupid question, but anyway, somebody's got to ask it, because they found specific proteins which occur in the whey portion of the milk, showing that they separated it into different containers. So, I mean, just being able to do that, it's astonishing technology. But it's also flagged up another issue for general practice in archaeology, and that is in the cleaning and preparation of specimens.
Okay.
Historically, a lot of time and trouble has gone into cleaning away residues from ceramics to expose the original surfaces. So what these new techniques are showing is that all the apparent grime and dirt that was being thrown away actually holds more information than anyone ever imagined. So,
of course. Okay.
Yep. So there's a new drive towards keeping all that gunk for separate analysis. Yeah.
Wow. Fantastic stuff. Wow. I do have to say, that segues rather nicely into this month's main theme.
It rather does, doesn't it? Yes, indeed it does. And the topic for this month, it's a question that goes through all our minds from time to time and seldom gets any significant answers. And the question is, how do we know that?
Yeah. In fact, I mean, so many things we just accept without any significant questioning at all. And the reason we decided in this podcast to discuss just how we know any of the things we talk about is because we heard ourselves talking about isotopes for the umpteenth time. And a friend of mine asked, well, what is an isotope anyway?
Yeah, fair question, I'd say.
Which made us think about all the things that just roll off our tongues, completely taking it for granted that anyone knows what it really means.
And I think we should point out here, from a physics and a biochemistry point of view, we are no experts. And I think essentially we've got a sort of a broad overview, a conceptual knowledge of stuff. I mean, simply because stuff keeps coming our way. And we look stuff up and think, oh, well, that's good. I know how that works, and then promptly forget it. So, so what we're trying to do here is explain things as best we can to those less sciencey listeners who might think that a gluon is a kind of costume jewelry, perhaps, or a quark is a kind of cheese.
Yes, indeed.
And you'd be right about that. But actually, gluons are the subatomic particles which glue quarks together. Did you know that, Rupert?
I did know that. Yeah. I did know that.
And hadrons are made of quarks.
You see,
so should we stop there?
I think it's probably a good idea because we'll start to lose listeners.
If we haven't already. No, honest, we're going to try and make this as painless as possible.
Yeah, well, the thing is that I think for most purposes, particularly in their uses in archaeology, if people can understand just conceptually how the practice is achieved, it makes a complete difference to your understanding of what people are actually doing. Any of you who have more solid science backgrounds, do feel free to email us with other explanations, maybe, or descriptions of the processes involved here, or any that you think we've missed out but should have included. Yeah, so we will attempt.
Before you jump out of this podcast, it doesn't involve quarks and hadrons.
No, it doesn't.
And that kind of stuff, and gluons. It's much more top level stuff. So, no numbers.
Indeed,
no numbers.
No, none at all. No. So we will. Actually, there are a few numbers, but they're easy numbers. So, we will attempt to give you potted explanations to a few of the techniques most commonly used in archaeology, in hopefully in a way that doesn't make you start yawning halfway through.
So what we've done, we've made this episode into a 10-hour special. sorry, that was a joke. Actually, no, in order to avoid making a 10-hour long podcast, we're actually going to assume a kind of base level of scientific knowledge, like stuff about how we know about atomic structure in the first place and things like that.
It's worth making the point here that if you are a real novice to physics and chemistry, it is so worthwhile getting yourself some student books like Science Explained or Understanding Geology. You can learn a lot about the broader concepts, which then make the finer details a lot easier to grasp. And
but not essential reading. It's only if you're really serious about understanding stuff.
But also, do you know, one of the things that I will gladly admit is, although it's a shame they don't do them anymore, but you remember Ladybird books?
Yeah.
Well, very, very often, if I was doing research on something that I really didn't know anything about at all, then I'd go and get a Ladybird book. So find out, well, what's the first thing that you tell young kids? Because sometimes I think that we tend to, you know, you hit an age point, you know, and there is this assumption that you know all this stuff that's gone before, when maybe you don't. And I found that actually going out and buying children's books, it gave you some building blocks that actually made everything that you did subsequently a lot easier to you know, really take on board. So that's my advice anyway.
So do you fancy kicking this off then? Because I mean, we seem to have been talking about isotopes and things for months, so why not start with what is an isotope?
Yeah, okay, absolutely. Yeah. Well, in a nutshell, every atom contains protons and neutrons, and the number of protons is always the same, but the number of neutrons can vary, and it's the different number of neutrons that defines an isotope.
Right.
So now I'm going to presume now that nobody has turned off already, but basically
it's a way of saying each element can have variants.
Exactly that. Exactly that. One of the lovely things about all these, nearly all the atoms and elements that you know about, they were created in the violent life cycles of stars. It's a wonderful thing. And they started off pretty much, they started off radioactive, gradually over vast periods of time, losing neutrons, becoming more stable. And pretty much everything that we recognize on Earth is made from those ancient, now stable atoms. So you could broadly say that for any element, the lower the number of neutrons, the more stable the atom. Okay, so if we take carbon, for example, so carbon has 6 protons and it can have 6, 7, or 8 neutrons. So you've got carbon 12 and carbon 13. Well, they are stable. And then you've got carbon 14, which we use for dating. And that's still radioactive, gradually decaying. So the rate of decay is measurable and is called its half-life. That allows us to calculate just how old organic remains can be. So it has a half-life of about 5,700 years.
Yeah.
Which means that every 5,700 years, it will have lost half of its C14 content.
And that's the fantastic thing about this kind of science. Once you've got a clue like that, you can hang all sorts of other things on top of it.
Yeah.
You can use it as a tool. It's like it's got its own little internal clock suddenly.
That's a lovely way of putting it. It has an internal clock.
Yeah.
And so how can they tell? How can archaeologists tell how old? So they dig up some charcoal at Stonehenge.
Yeah.
How do they know how old it is? Well, the thing is that all organisms, and animals, plants, anything organic, without exception, absorbs carbon during its lifetime. Now, nearly all of that is C12. Okay, so nearly all of it is the stable isotope. Yeah. Of carbon, C12. But there is a tiny proportion of that, measurable proportion, which is C14. And by measuring the ratio of carbon-12 against carbon-14, they can tell how long it is since the organism died, because at the time of death, the absorption of carbon stops.
Right. So for every kind of organism, we have a base knowledge of the normal ratio in life of C12 to C14.
Absolutely.
When they die, that ratio is going to change over time, and we know the rate that that's going to change at, so therefore we can calculate how long since it died.
That's it, exactly. So basically the carbon-12 stays the same, the carbon-14 diminishes.
Yeah.
And by comparing one with the other, they can tell how long it is since it stopped absorbing carbon.
Marvellous, marvellous.
So I hope that makes sense anyway. That's about the clearest way I can think of it. describing it.
Yeah.
but as I said, you know, the basic point is think of any element as a family of isotopes where each member of the family has a different weight.
Right. I mean, it's just breathtaking, really, how much of our knowledge has exploded since technology allowed us to isolate these atomic variations. So you talked about carbon dating using the radioactive isotope. So Maybe it's a good time to bring up the uses of stable isotopes, and there are some. I think one of the revelations we both found so exciting was when they found that a lot of the cattle remains at Durrington had come from Orkney. Now,
yes. Yeah,
I mean, but that's a technology that has totally changed our understanding of Neolithic life.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Another aspect of isotope technology is that regional variations of vegetation are almost as unique as fingerprints.
Mm.
Geographically, they vary in very distinct ways with humidity and temperature. So isotopes of oxygen, carbon, and hydrogen can get eaten by the cattle and then transfer into tissues like keratin or teeth. And once locked into the inert tissue...
So by inert, you mean tissues that don't change once they've grown?
Yes, that way around. Exactly. So if the isotopes from the plants transferred to a cow's tooth on Orkney, say when it was growing adult teeth, that same isotope would be locked in for the rest of its life.
Yeah, worth mentioning that there is a staggering amount of plodding work done, compiling databases of all the different data. So when new samples are taken, every time new samples are taken, they have more and more things catalogued to compare and find matches.
That's right. It's cataloguing what isotopes exist in the real world geographically. That's got to be known in the first place.
Yeah.
So that each area has its own isotope fingerprint, and then you can match those isotopes from, after the event, from such organic remains to match to those particular areas. It's a thing that they use in forensics. The police use in forensics.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well,
while we're still on isotopes, another process that we do talk about, you might have heard us talking about, and we mention it from time to time, is mass spectrometry, especially for things like protein analysis. So earlier on, we were talking about, in fact, you mentioned the different cheeses found at Cattle Hoyuk from the remains in ceramic jugs and what have you. And it's mass spectrometry that's used for things like that, because we don't really need to discuss particle accelerators, but in the simplest terms, the mass in mass spectrometry refers to atomic weight, and the process involves separating out the different isotopes by using very powerful magnetic fields, and that's how they can tell one set of proteins from another.
So. Yeah, it's fingerprinting of a sort, but you've got to have this separation out of the isotopes, get the ratios so that you can match them, But we're talking about, it's another way of getting the same result, mass spectrometry, is it not? Am I right?
Yes. Misunderstanding? Yeah.
Of finding out what the ratios between the isotopes are. So yeah, isotopes. Gosh, who knew?
Do you know what I have to say? That whilst we talk about these things conceptually, and it makes perfect sense when you talk about it in these broad terms. But then I don't know if you've ever seen the data that comes out. When they've been doing this kind of thing in the lab, you think, how do you make head or tail of any of that? Actually,
well,
the breathtaking skill of the technicians involved in any of this work, it's quite staggering, really.
I think it's a really good point, Rupert, because I think there's a misconception that people just bung this stuff in the machine and the machine coughs out the result. Far far from it. There is so much work that has to be done in an understanding that has to be had in preparation of these things for analysis. You've really got to understand completely the process that's being gone through in order to extract the result at the end. And I'm thinking...
I am in awe of these people.
Absolutely. I mean, it is another area of archaeology that would be completely lost to me because it is so painstaking.
Yeah.
It's not very exciting, but the results themselves are, and it takes a long time.
Yeah. Fortunately, some people are excited by it.
Yes. We were talking about magnets and stuff and
mass
spectrometry and stuff. So the word sort of magnetometry seeps into my brain.
And would we be?
And I think, well, exactly. But I'm thinking the first time I really heard it properly was when I was reading for the first time about the results they got at Stanton Drew.
Yeah.
Well, the funny thing is, it's down to trace elements, and again, in this case, iron. How they get the results from magnetometry out of the soil. See, soil, even at the tiniest levels, has magnetic qualities, and any variations in the soil quality or chemical makeup will show up when the magnetic feedback is mapped. So, using some high tech. Portable equipment, you walk across the ground taking readings, which then can be converted into a composite made-up image of the response in the soil. And any magnetic disturbances will show up, especially if there's been burning. But any significant changes in the soil will become visible. Henge ditches, as Stanton Drew, you know, a very good example. And, of course, post holes,
Yeah, I must admit, I mean, it was a real surprise to me when I first saw how clearly the differences show up just because of tiny iron fluctuations in the soil.
Yeah.
But I mean, the thing is, tiny differences are all you need for a lot of things. You know, another important technique that we should mention here is trace element geochemistry. Now, sounds wonderful, doesn't it? Trace element geochemistry. But so, for example, how do we know that Langdale axes actually came from the quarry on the top of Pike of Stickle?
That's a question that has bugged me for ages.
It is a damn good question. How do we know? And this is actually remarkably similar in principle to the geographical pinpointing of isotopes. But this is using the distinct variations of rock types as they appear in different locations. And the key here is that dealing with trace elements, you know, at the most detailed levels, no two locations will ever be exactly the same. It's a bit like getting 100 people to bake a cake, all of them with the same ingredients, and the flour and the sugar and the eggs may all be very, very similar. But the way that dash of vanilla essence, say, and that handful of raisins, the way they're put in by each individual chef, well, they will be different in every cake. And those tiny little ingredients, those tiny differences that are the fingerprint of any location. So it sounds extreme, but that's how, when they can take a piece of rock from anywhere, and so long as it's on the database, and this is why the work that's done in the background that nobody ever talks about, but this work is going on all the time, where people are taking samples, geological samples, everywhere, and it all goes into the database so that every single location that has been studied it's got its own markers on the list, and so you can do an analysis of a rock from, you know, whatever site, you know, say they dig something up in Stonehenge, you know, and they actually found out that it came from northern France or Italy or wherever, because the rocks are different,
And the results are reliable in that case, aren't they?
They really are. It sounds crazy. And there's a lot of people who can be quite sceptical of that, saying, well, surely some places are the same. No, they're not. They're not. Mm-hmm. In exactly the same way as, you know, you've got, however many billion people on the planet, and you stand all of them in a line next to each other, and it's very, very rare that you come across two people that look the same.
But it's relevant to point out that prior to these technological advances in physics and chemistry, so many archaeological distinctions and evaluations were made simply on the basis of typology and style. I mean, things looking the same.
Yeah, that's very true. Good point.
Just the appearance of it. That looks similar to this, so it must be the same culture. It must be the same time frame. And I think that's led to quite a lot of errors in the past, or errors, you know, certainly that have been corrected by, and surprises that have come up when technology, the modern technology, has been applied to what we thought we knew.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, you think, you know, some of the things we've talked about in earlier podcasts, you know, where they have had another look at something that was excavated, you know, maybe even 30 years ago. Yeah. I mean, well, in fact, look at Ötzi, for example.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the Iceman.
Yeah.
That we thought we knew all sorts of things here, there, and everywhere, but because of this new technology, we're now finding that, you know, that his copper axe came from Austria, or just stuff that we thought we knew and we actually didn't.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
What happens? We don't suddenly know everything. We don't suddenly update everything simply because the technology exists. It has to be actually applied. And this comes up in a site that we both know quite well, and that's the Rollright Stones. I think we mentioned the date in Standing with Stones, the film, and whenever I talk to people about the Rollright Stones, so I say it's 4,500 years old or whatever. But that date is not firm at all. The Whispering Knights and the King's Men, it's all done with typology. The circle is dated because it looks like some of the Cumbrian circles. The Whispering Knights are dated because they look like other dolmens of the same sort that have been dated. So in my mind, those datings become very unreliable indeed.
Yes.
You know, archaeologists, it's their job to be able to say something when the public demands certainty, and you know, how old is that? Well, they've got to be able to say something, otherwise they look stupid.
Yes.
But the basis upon which the information is being conveyed is actually not really that reliable if you think about it, and allows for huge.
Yeah. No, it's true. I think there's going to be a very long, slow process of reassessing so much of the, you know, particularly any of the archaeology that was done more than, say, 20 to 30 years ago, you know, needs to be reassessed. Not because as recently as 30 years ago they were making massive mistakes, but just because there's things that we assumed, as you say, because of typology, you know, that it looked like this. And there are things that we now have the technology to actually measure rather than interpret. And that's going to make a big difference moving forward.
Yeah.
It's very exciting. You know what? I think it is also essential to say that a lot of our new understanding is profoundly non-technological and you know, based much more in our modern standards of rigor and analysis. You know, probably the biggest surprise to me was when we were making the film at Devil's Quoits, and I was reading the excavation report, and I had no idea that when they dig down making a trench, they can extract every species of snail and deduce exactly how the surface was at different periods because of the known behaviours of each species. I had no idea. I mean, for example, some snails of, you know, I mean, the thing is, we know this, we just don't apply the knowledge. Like really shady, moist environments. Others prefer more light and warmth and only feed on certain plants, you know, et cetera. So, you know, obviously that kind of analysis requires rigor and knowledge.
And sheer hard work.
It's essentially simple.
Essentially simple, but it requires real hard work to extract the information. I was saying before, I think people don't appreciate the sweat that must go on the brow and the hours and hours and hours that go into producing the analyses we have. So, you know, hats off to those guys in the back room sorting snail from snail. And
Absolutely. But,
as we said at the beginning, I suppose we could go on for hours.
we really could. But realistically, I think our time is about up, really. So we should probably move on.
All right. Well, we really do hope that's been informative. I mean, as usual, on the link on the, as usual, there'll be links on the website for further reading if you want to get more into the techno details of any of this. But I hope that wasn't too deep, and also gives you a sense of confidence in the stuff that you read about, you know, about sites in terms of dating, in terms of geography, in terms of, you know, these things are just not made up. They're not just, a lot of stuff is not just theorizing. It's based on real stuff that can be shown.
Yes, absolutely.
And demonstrated. Yeah.
Wonderful stuff.
What on earth is that noise?
I'm glad you can hear that. That is the cat knocking on my window saying he wants to come in. He will carry on doing that until I go and open the door. I will be back in a moment. God bloody hell.
I think we might keep this in.
So that brings us to question time. Have we got anything arisen this month, Michael?
Well, fortunately, yes. we have a question from Jeanette Sanderson, who's down in Cornwall.
And
who asks, how do I get more involved with archaeology as an amateur?
That is a lovely question. Well, I would say the simplest answer is to join a local group, really. In fact, if you go to somewhere like the Council for British Archaeology. We'll put links on the website. There's the Council for British Archaeology, and they have lists of pretty much all the archaeology groups around around Britain. They offer all sorts of hands-on activities and training. There's even a young archaeologists club, actually, if you want to encourage your kids to get involved. Maybe. We'll put links up, as I said. Having said that, you went on a dig with Tim Darville, Mike, a couple of months back. How did you get involved with that?
Well, I didn't actually go on it. I mean, I was invited up for a day by a friend of mine who was actually on the dig and spent a number of weeks up there. Yes, it was the Sisters Longbarrow dig, which not many people know about.
No, indeed.
There will be stuff coming out in the years that follow, but Mr. Darville plays things close to his chest. Anyway, no, the point is, I was invited up there, but I would like to go back next year. And so what I'll be doing is looking on Bournemouth University's website, finding Mr. Darville out, and sending him an email requesting to volunteer for the dig. I think that's the trick. If you can find out, or another angle on it, if you can find out where a dig is happening, find out which university or which organization is driving it, is responsible for it, find out through that who's in charge of it, and, you know, just ask via email. However, it's not always easy to find out where digs are going on. I think this is where somewhere like Council for British Archaeology, and there are a couple of other places as well. Current Archaeology, the publication, so that's www.archaeology.co.uk, have a page where they list digs that may be looking for volunteers. It is not comprehensive, but it's a good starting point. So that would be...
It's surprising. I mean, the different ways that you can handle anything like this. You know, you could also do a search online for things like, you know, volunteering holidays. You know, it's amazing the amount of things. I mean, obviously, you'd need to stick in volunteer archaeology and see what comes up.
Yeah, yes. I was just going to say with the archaeology.co.uk/digs is where you want to go.
Right.
And you can search by time period, you can search by location, you can search by whether you have to charge you have to pay a fee to get involved. That kind of thing. Another place is Dig Ventures, which is digventures.com. Well, they're slightly different in that they help with funding of excavations and digs via crowdfunding and crowdsourcing.
Do they?
So they're all about putting people together, as far as I can make out, not only people, but putting the money together as well to make sure that certain places, certain digs take place. So right. They certainly have a place where you can find out if there's a dig that appeals to you. And I think there are also a couple of international ones if you might be interested in taking part in a dig on foreign shores. There are a couple of places, pasthorizons.com/worldprojects would be a place to go as well. We're talking as if you're asking about getting involved specifically in a dig. But archaeology per se as an amateur, then I think it's really down to finding the local organizations. And we're back to the Council for British Archaeology.
Right? I think the interesting thing, as you say, back to the Council for British Archaeology, the thing is that there's probably a lot of things that they can offer that you may not even have considered.
Yeah.
You know, it might not even have crossed your mind that's there as an option. They talk about training. I'll be brutally honest, I have no idea what those training things might be. It might be about the necessary skills on an archaeological dig, but it could just as easily be flintknapping. I don't know.
Yes.
It's certainly worth looking into.
Yes, and of course, archaeology isn't just about the stuff we do. Neolithic and Bronze Age covers everything.
Absolutely.
Yeah. In the ground.
Yes, I mean, the amount of people that go, what do they call it? The people that go along the banks of the... When the tide is out, they go along the Thames, pulling out all sorts of stuff from, medieval London and things like that. There's all sorts of things you can do.
Yes, there is a word and I can't think of it.
No, neither can I.
Thanks for bringing that up. So, I hope that's a reasonable answer to the question, Jeanette. And, good luck with that. Let us know.
Indeed.
How you get on. So, onward.
Yes, do. Keep
onward.
Us posted. Yeah.
Ever onward. What could it be that is next, I believe?
I'll tell you what's next.
Tell me what's next.
It's Stonehead of the Month.
Stonehead of the Month? We're going all over the place with Stonehead of the Month, aren't we? And it's true to form. Tell us who Stonehead of the Month is this month.
Stonehead of the Month this month is our youngest fan.
Yay!
This is Angel Keown. Now, this might sound, some of you might know, it's weighted in one direction, but Angel's mum, Mo, was Stonehead of the Month a little while back, but Angel...
She was our very first
big fan of
Stonehead of the Month.
Stonehead of the Month. And Angel, 10 years old, and she's just really getting into it. And she's mentioned standing with stones in her school project. So, we couldn't let that pass unnoticed.
That's right. My understanding is that Angel has just completed an extraordinary school project in which she's written a piece about Grimes Graves and Avebury all together.
Indeed.
Yeah. So I would like to see that paper.
So would I.
And congratulations for, also for having a great mum that's going to take you to these places as well.
Yes. Hats off to Mo. You see, Mo should get another credit there, shouldn't she?
Well, she is. We'll think of something. By default here, yes. But no, big hats off to Angel, and particularly also Angel for the magnificent cover of your project. I think choosing gold and silver sequin things to map out the words Grimes, Graves and Avery is a touch of genius.
Top marks.
Yay, top marks to you. Hooray, well done.
Yeah, well done. Well done, Angel. So, getting towards the end, aren't we? So, do you know where we're going now?
Where?
I think we must be going Whimsy. Have you got Whimsy?
Yes, but I haven't told the doctor yet. Yeah, we're going to Whimsy. Where is Whimsy, by the way? I don't know, is Whimsy a good name? Is there another name we could use for this? Slightly amusing. This is the slightly amusing section. Of the Stanley yes. Stones podcast.
Yes, the light-hearted section.
Yeah, it's still pretty weak, isn't it? No, Whimsy. Yeah, we'll stick really, to yeah. stick to Whimsy for the time being. Anyway, what is Whimsy this week? Am I going to tell you? Or
yeah, I'm relying on you here.
Okay, Whimsy. Well, it's not exactly laugh out loud or anything like that, but it's a light touch, and it's a very nice light touch from English Heritage on their Stonehenge site, the Stonehenge Centenary site, indeed. Oh, right. And I'll tell you how this happened. It's one of those things. I mean, I'm always trawling about for little trinkets and stuff, pictures, links to articles to link through to post on our Standing with Stones community. And this one came up, a lovely photograph of four young ladies, looked like they were standing in front of the Stonehenge monument around circa 1920. Yes. It was a lovely black and white photograph. So I thought, I'll have that. I'll nick that off Twitter and posted it on the Standing with Stones community, not having clicked through the link. And it was only after it had been up a day or so, I clicked through on the link, and lo and behold, there's a lovely thing on the Stonehenge Centenary website whereby you can upload your own photograph of you or your family or something that you have at Stonehenge and put a description in your story of what that photograph is about. And it can be from any time from 1850 right up to the present day. And what happens is your photograph is taken up there, and it's put on this sort of 3D carousel picture that they've got.
Oh, right.
of Stonehenge, and all these photographs float around it in 3D, and you can move it around and choose a photograph at random, and you know, one of these photographs will come up that somebody somewhere has uploaded. And there's some fascinating old black and white stuff, some new stuff, you know, people remembering when they went on a school trip and, you know, happened to take a photograph, and all sorts of just touching little family memories and whatever you like put up there. It's just an amusing little trinket, and it's
nice
one.
Fantastic. Yeah. Have they got many up there so far?
Quite a few. All you do, you go to www.stonehenge100.co.uk/entries, and you upload a photograph, put a description in, put your name on. You can also upload an audio description, if you like, of the photograph, and that's you know, and people see that or hear that when they click on the photograph. And I think there's something at the end, one story will be chosen or something. There's a, I don't know if there's a prize or something like that, but it'll be featured anyway. But I just thought it was nice. You know,
is nice. Yeah.
And there are some fascinating little backstories to people's photographs of them as kids sitting on the stones, you know, back in the days when you could wander up to the stones, and or maybe maybe it cost threepence. There's one, you know, remembering, oh, it cost threepence to go up and stand among the stones. Yeah.
How times do change.
Indeed. So that is it. That is That is the light touch. That is the whimsy.
Lovely.
Podcast number 7, which brings us towards the end.
It does indeed.
My goodness gracious me. There's another one gone. What are we going to do?
Start working on the next one.
Indeed. So, folks, thank you. Thank you so much for listening. We really hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, please consider helping us create this podcast and more great films and other stuff and interviews. Just go through to the Patreon website at patreon.com/standingwithstones and see if there's a level at which you'd like to support us doing the podcast and the films and lots more. I mean, there are loads of rewards and perks to choose from, and for as little as $1 a month,
the packet of crisps, become
one of the Standing with Stones team. you might even get a free Standing with Stones baseball cap.
A thing of beauty.
Think on that. So that's it. Thank you so much once again.
Thank you so much, folks.
We do appreciate it, and do appreciate your feedback and continued support. See you all around very, very soon indeed.
See you next time.
Ta-ta for now.